Welcome to the Perry Johnson Laboratory Accreditation Podcast, where you can expect the latest news and discussions relevant to the laboratory accreditation industry. Today's episode is a previously recorded webinar. If you'd like to tune into our upcoming webinars, visit our website at www.pjlabs.com or give us a follow on your favorite podcast app. Thank you for tuning in.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our webinar this afternoon. We're going to be discussing measurement uncertainty and decision rules. For those that are familiar with ISO 17025, these topics are a pretty hot topic and should be recognizable to you. And we have a guest speaker today, Dr. Susan Adino from Adino and Susan Adino and Associates, and she's going to discuss this topic. We are going to bring in the cannabis industry a little bit into this presentation because we do accredit a lot of laboratories in this area, but this particular topic is something that does need to be addressed in this industry and also can be used again in other industries as well, where customers may want a result, but how do you accomplish that decision rule requirement? Next slide. Okay, so Susan's going to touch upon a few topics. We only have 30 to 40 minutes, so she can't necessarily show you how to do a whole measurement uncertainty calculation, but we're going to go over some topics on how to get to that point, review the requirement of 17025, and how to apply those decision rules. Next slide. Okay, as you may have noticed, everyone on the webinar today is muted. You will have time for questions at the end. If you look to your right there in your questions toolbar throughout the presentation, feel free to, if something comes to mind, type in your questions and we will get to those at the very end. This webinar is being recorded, so if you can't make it for the whole session today, it will be available for download on our website shortly after the session is finished. And again, please feel free to use those questions toolbars at the as things come to mind, and Susan will be happy to answer them for you. Next slide. Okay, with that, I'm going to go ahead and hand this over to Susan. Susan, thank you so much. I will let you go ahead and introduce yourself, and we will go ahead and get started. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Tracy. That was great. Great introduction, and thank you for the opportunity to be here. Thanks for the invitation. My name is Susan, and I'm a chemist and a chemometrician, so I've done a lot of work in statistics. My PhD really is in chemistry, however. I've been an assessor for accreditation bodies for, gosh, well over a decade, probably closer to 15 years. And I'm very involved in the cannabis industry on a number of levels, very involved with AOAC and the great work that's happening there. I've worked with internationally and nationally accreditation bodies and governments in the establishment of regulations. I've worked with a lot of state governments here in the United States on regulations and quality assurance in the laboratories. I also have been a board member and trustee at college and a board member and advisory member for a number of private laboratories as well as public and other nonprofit agencies. It's also important to note that I really don't answer to anybody. I work completely independently. So my opinion is really my opinion. I'm not on anybody's payroll as an employee. I don't own stock equity or any shares or stakeholder interests in any cannabis or cannabis related industry. And I think that that's important as a consultant because as a scientist, it keeps me honest. It keeps me really focused on the integrity of science. So thanks for joining in today. Thanks for being here. And thank you again to Tracy and everybody at PJLA. All right, to be or not to be in the session, some of the things that we're going to talk about and some of the things that we just don't have time to talk about is, as Tracy mentioned, we're going to have a very broad discussion about measurement uncertainty and what role it plays or may not play in a decision rule. How do we actually get to measurement uncertainty? How we calculate measurement uncertainty? Well, That's a much bigger topic, and there are many ways to do that, none of which we're really going to get into here. So I'm not going to talk about how we're calculating it here. We are going to talk about some conformity specifications, but I'm not going to talk about how they became conformity specifications. And we are going to look at some hypothetical data, and it's going to include assumptions and be very, very simplified just to illustrate a point. I'm really not going to go over the assumptions. I'm not going to go over, you know, the intricacies of that data. And again, I'm not going to go over the specific calculations or methods to calculate measurement uncertainty here. It's a much bigger topic that deserves more attention and more time. This session here is really focused on how or if measurement uncertainty is related to decision rules and statements of conformity. So let's start with a decision rule. Well, 17025 tells us that, you know, it does have a role in 17025 in the quality of laboratories. And we know that decision rules are all around us and they have a very special meaning in laboratory science. If you think about food recalls, they're typically mean or are in place because some food item has been affected by some pathogen or other impurity beyond some acceptable limit or threshold. What would happen if that threshold were fluid or constantly moving, or if the call to stop selling or recall an item was subjective and left to one person? Not very comforting, right? So the rules are in place to provide a level of certainty around specific decisions. Think about it even with your car. When you go to the mechanic and he looks at your tires and they say, well, your tires are a little bit worn. The lowest you can go on your tread depth is, well, I don't know, 1.5 or 1.6 millimeters, and you're at 1.7. Well, you're not at that danger level, but are you willing to take the risk? So laboratory science, especially in our new world of cannabis, decision rules have a tremendous impact. So these decision rules are impacting the laboratory and a customer. Customer doesn't get the desirable results, then they may take their business elsewhere. What about the impact between the customer and the regulatory body? The customer sample doesn't meet a specification, they may be forced to dispose of their products or crops. And then there's the impact within the laboratory itself. Without good rules to determine whether or not something is in spec or out of spec, could lead to discomfort and animosity among scientists. So ISO says that decision rules describe how uncertainty is accounted for when we are making statements of conformity to a specified requirement. So measurement uncertainty is an interesting concept, but what does it mean and how does it really affect decision rules? So let's take a look at some hypothetical test results, and I will admit that I made these up, everything up, as you will see. So some specification somewhere says that the accepted value for this particular kind of plastic is 4.25. Well, one of the lab's first course of action is to go get a CRM, a certified reference material, for the same plastic, and we find that its certified value is 4.5. So we come here and we look at the results of 15 samples that we ran, and based on the decision rule, that 4.25 is our limit, right? We're going to make some decisions. So anything above 4.25 is a failure. Well, it looks like based on these things, we have some pretty clear failures and some pretty clear passing. And then we have some that's like, oh, wow, boy, you just made it in there. And this one, I don't know what we would do at this point here, point number two. But we'll talk a little bit more about that. Where'd my slide go? Before we conclude the story, let's look at some of the other variables or players in the story, okay? Let's begin with answering the question, how right or how correct is my test result to begin with? So remember that we're talking about measurement error, right? How correct is that test result? And recall that the CRM here is 4.5. So if we look at our little data chart here on the right, we see that there is some error, or the difference between our test result and the known value or the recognized value. In our case, it's the CRM value. and haven't even gone into what does the CRM take into consideration or how pure that is. So for the sake of this argument, let's just assume it's 100% pure. Okay. So contributions to these errors are both systematic and random. No measurement, no test result ever in any world is ever without some uncertainty or some error. So what we're really talking about here is accuracy, right? The next player in our story is precision. What is the spread of our results in relation to each other? So the contributions to precision include repeatability. And so basically the variability of responses by the same analyst using the same instrument over some short period of time. And then also measurement reproducibility, so the variability of results between laboratories. In order to get the best handle on the trueness or the correctness of our testing result, we would need to have an infinite number of tests, right? And we also know that that's not possible. Can you imagine going to your lab director or your CSO or the CEO of your laboratory and saying, I really want to get a true answer here. So I need an unlimited amount of CRMs and an unlimited amount of time so I can run this a million times and get the tightest value for the trueness of this particular assay. It would be kind of funny, right? So what does that mean? It means that we enter the next player into our game, which is bias. And so bias is pretty similar to error in that it's in its quest, it is rooted to stuff that we can actually measure. It's basically the laboratory's average test results, our test value, and the known or reference value. We have to remember that contributions to bias include both method bias and laboratory bias. So with a method bias, it doesn't really matter who's doing it, which instrument we're running. The method is biased. And then we also have the laboratory's bias, and these are specific by my laboratory and going to be different from your laboratory and so on and so forth. Both of these are influenced by random and systematic sources. Okay. So can we correctly measure the trueness or correctness of our test results? Probably not directly. We have to go by this bias route. There are typically three ways to measure bias. One is by using a reference material. In our case, we're looking at a CRM here. Another is by recovery studies. The third way is really by comparison with other methods. Two most common ways, I think, that I've seen in labs is by using a CRM or recovery studies. But keep in mind that when we fortify a material, when we spike a material, not all of that spike material is going to adhere to or bind to the actual sample, and that's going to influence our recovery as well. Okay, so let's go back to our hypothetical case here. Recall that the CRM is 4.5. Well, I went ahead and I calculated the bias, okay, for our little laboratory mean. We have our lab mean minus the CRM, so we have a bias of minus 0.25. We put that into a percentage, we're looking at minus 5.7%. Okay. If we take a closer look, let's look at this picture, right? Now, the difference between where we are, 4.25, and the CRM, 4.5, we have the bias, okay? So let's go back to this picture. And so far, or up to now, we've been really concerned with how correct is my test result. And as we're reminded of our real data here, or hypothetical data here, I ask you to consider a different question. And that is, how confident am I in my test result? So here we have this plot. We have our data. How confident are we in all of those things? I'm not sure. And now I'm looking at this line here again, this 4.25 threshold or cutoff line, and I'm still feeling a little bit uneasy about some things, but let's see what happens. So the next player in our little game here, in our story, is measurement uncertainty. Why do we, or should I say, why should we care about measurement uncertainty? Well, basically, knowing measurement uncertainty will add value and meaning to the perspective of test results so that we can make appropriate business decisions. How many business decisions or life decisions do you make on the basis of one value? You're always looking for something a little bit more or a little bit less, right? So we should care about measurement uncertainty because it adds confidence to our test results. And then when those test results are subject to statements of conformity, it gives us a better firm footing, I think. Otherwise, it feels like kind of walking on jello. So in my opinion, using measurement uncertainty, the laboratory is really defending its reputation. Okay. Is the laboratory ready to put its line on the reputation when making a statement of conformity and not considering measurement uncertainty? Well, the labs are essentially accredited to 17025 for a reason. And as we look at 17025, we see that there are a few places where the standard actually calls out decision rules. How about that? So I think there are about six or seven places in the standard. We're not going to talk about all of them, but here are a couple. So 7.6 says we need to identify contributions to uncertainty and we need to evaluate uncertainty. 7.8 requires the documentation of a decision rule employed whenever there's a statement of conformity made, required. Okay, so again, statement of conformity passes or doesn't pass, pass or fail, or in specification, out of specification. Okay. So 7.8 in the standard says that we have to, whenever stating a conformity, we have to include the decision rule that was employed, and we have to take into consideration the risk level. So again, false accept, false reject, so type one, type two errors, as well as the statistical assumptions that went into that determination. So whether we report this out on the certificate of analysis or test report, or we retain it, the laboratory is still required to do this work, even if it may not be reported out on the COA. Remember, section 7.8 says, unless there's a valid reason for not doing so, this information needs to be there. So, all right. When we talk about how confident am I in my test result, how confident is that test result really the value and not some other value? We're really talking about the normal curve. And I know that this may cause some indigestion for people, but I encourage you to go back into your brains and remember this from basic statistics, however many years ago. Okay. I assure you this curve continues to have value and meaning in your life as a scientist. We also have heard things in 17025 around coverage factors or K value. It's really not that scary. It sounds scary, but it's really not that scary. So if we look at a K of one, a K value of one, we're saying that we want to know within 68% confidence the range in which my test result actually falls, okay? And again, K equals two is 95%. How confident, or what are the confidence, 95% confident bands where my true value really lies, okay? And again, if we go up to K equals three, then we're looking at 99.7% of the data. So again, this isn't answering the question, how correct is my data? How correct am I to the known value? When we're looking at this, we're looking at how sure am I? How confident am I that my test value is what I say it is, what I believe it to be? So we're looking at that range. Okay. I always like looking at these intervals because they make us balance some things, right? And we have choices here. So when we look at this, we see that the tightest range, right? So this K equals one range down here is the tightest range of values, but it also has the lowest confidence. Whereas the broadest range, so more possible numbers, has the greatest confidence. So I don't know. I just always thought that was kind of cool and interesting to look at. Maybe I'm just kind of weird when it comes to the normal curve. So if we put this into perspective and we come back to our hypothetical data, I went ahead and I did a quick calculation for uncertainty and expanded uncertainty. So K of two. K of two in our industry is most typical. Okay. There are many ways to calculate it, so I'm not going to go there. As a statistician, I happen to learn the classical way to do this. I think it's the most robust and it makes the most sense, but it also causes people indigestion and major anxiety attacks, so I don't recommend that you run out and do that. There are easier ways, and if you want more information, I have some references at the end that I think could help, and there are also classes and instructors out there to help you. But once you learn it, it really does become a great tool for the laboratory. It becomes a really good help for the laboratory on an ongoing basis, but I digress here. For the sake of our hypothetical situation, I went ahead and used the equation to calculate uncertainty, and then I imposed that, right? I used that uncertainty to come up with my limits. So here are our test results again. And using that uncertainty data, I put in the lower and upper limits. Now, look over here. Look in this far right column. I went from pass, pass, fail, fail, pass, fail. When I imposed my uncertainty, now my failure, what I think was a failure, I have now classified as indeterminate. What I classified here, when I looked at my chart, when I got my result, I see a pass, right? Because it's under 4.25, it looks like a pass. But look at my banding here. It's also indeterminate. I'm not that confident that it really is a pass. It could be a failure. And then I come down here and I see another point where, although it looks like a failure, it's greater than 4.25, but my confidence band says it's going to run somewhere between 4.207 and 4.387. So yeah, it seems like it's a failure, but I'm not willing to put my reputation on that. So I'm now in that mode of thinking, well, this is actually indeterminate. So let's see what happens if I impose a K of three, so a coverage factor of three, which is giving me 99% certainty or confidence bands for where my true value falls. Well, the same is true for the K of two, but now look what's happened here at point number 10, right? Now that is also becoming indeterminate. Okay, I don't know, maybe it really is passing. But let's take a look and see, look at our data again, okay? We're gonna come back to our data, but let's revisit what a decision rule is. Okay, the decision rule, again, is describing how we're using these determinations of measurement uncertainty to make decisions. This is a rule that describes how we're accounting, how have we determine the uncertainty and the contributions to uncertainty, and how are we accounting for that when we are stating conformity with a specified requirement. Most of these requirements, again, are binary, pass or fail, in spec, out of spec, intolerance, out of tolerance. Okay. So remember I said that 17025 has several references to statements of conformity and decision rules. Well, here's another one, 7.1.3. In the cannabis industry, and again, it applies to everybody, but in the cannabis industry, it's pretty clear. And many of the samples that are submitted for what they call compliance testing, the state regulations dictate what those specification limits are. Okay, so the decision rule is specified by the regulating body. Okay. And laboratory is responsible for making sure that that comes through on the test report, which is in section 7.8. So 7.8 says, where necessary for the interpretation of test results, we have to include the statement of conformity with the specifications. So the customer needs to understand the decision rules in order to appropriately and confidently interpret those test results. And again, 7.8, that whole section 7.8, clause 7.8 is all on test reports and certificates of analysis issued by the laboratory. So let's come back. We're back to our hypothetical data again. And now this time I put in some error bars, which for this illustration is nothing other than plus or minus the measurement uncertainty. So let's look at our confidence in making decisions. I suggest that we consider looking at the uncertainty of measurements. Some of our decisions may not be clear cut. So here we have some, three, four, five incidents where I'm not so sure. Because when we started looking at this data, I was pretty sure that points one and two were really passing, and I was pretty clear that point three was really failing. But now when I put in that confidence, that uncertainty, those confidence intervals, I'm not so sure. I don't know, what do you guys think? Are you sure? Are you willing to put your reputation on the line on these sort of fuzzy values? I don't know. But these differences are due to a host of systematic and random contributions that theoretically the laboratory has calculated, has determined. So what are the sources of measurement uncertainty? Well, this is really just a short list, and there are many other contributions that the laboratory has to evaluate. And as you evaluate all of the sources, you get to determine which ones are significant contributions and which ones really don't make any sense to be there. So the color of my pencil or the color of my pen is irrelevant. Is that a source of uncertainty? No. It absolutely is not. Maybe a specific pipette is a source of uncertainty. And if so, we can get those contributions from the calibration reports. So remember that when we're calibrating an instrument, we're in a piece of equipment, your balance, your check weights, your thermometer, your pipettes, and the list goes on and on and on. The uncertainties for each of those major contributions is listed there on your calibration report. It's there for a reason. So what's actually happening in the cannabis industry? Well, we have many regs that have decision rules. And we know that there's no need to go into the details here, but it is important to note that decision rules do not include the application of measurement uncertainty. I remember I was working with a particular state regulator who said, well, laboratories have to calculate measurement uncertainty. And I said, well, okay, so here's a test result. When we put these error bars on here, how are they supposed to report that? Oh, I understand what you mean now. Yeah, they still have to report that as a fail, even though there's a slim chance it actually failed. So we have throughout the country independent regulatory bodies that are saying, go calculate your uncertainty, but then ignore that and make a decision on basis of a single value. And what's further muddying the water here is that sometimes those single values are less than the limits of quantitation, which by definition are unreliable. So now we're making a decision on the basis of an unreliable number, an unreliable test value, and we're not allowed to put in uncertainty on that. So let's take one last look at our hypothetical data. Okay, here we have our error bars, we have our threshold, and here we have what we think are passing or failing things. And I would suggest, in my opinion, that we would change these pass or failures to a conditional pass or a conditional failure, so that it is being, in all fairness to the data and in all fairness to the customer of this data, that what appears to be a pass may in fact have a risk of actually failing. So again, let's come back to how can cannabis labs navigate and balance their risks when their regulatory body requires them to impose a decision based on a single value in isolation, especially when that test value is by definition unreliable. So I would suggest a compromise of sorts, right? Because the laboratory has to report on the COA, the specification, and they have to comply with the regulatory body. So here we have our classic test result 4.31, and the specification is fail as per the regulatory group. Yikes. I thought that was kind of clever at the moment. But the laboratory can also add, for the benefit of the customer, additional statements. It could say something like, the calculated expanded uncertainty for 95% level of confidence is 0.9, and then let the customer go figure out what that means and what to do with it. Or the lab could make an additional comment that says, based on expanded measurement uncertainty for 95% level of confidence, this test result is considered conditional fail or indeterminate. Or it could say the calculated expanded uncertainty for 95% level of confidence is 0.09. This means that the true value of plastic is expected to be between 4.22 and 4.40. So there are opportunities for the laboratory to comply with the regulatory body while also giving the customer more information to make a more educated business decision. You know, if we think about the regular world when we're building something, we're always told measure twice, cut once, measure twice, cut once. That's to be sure that you are making that final decision appropriately, and it really should be applied to our industry as well. So can you imagine if our houses were built with measure once, cut once, and measure with an unreliable tape measure? It would be pretty scary for all of us, right? At the end, we need to be certain that our decisions are made confidently, and our confidence has a band. We have a bandwidth. Our customers are making big decisions based on their lab's test report. So we have to be nice to them, and we have to respect the limits of our science. So overall, the industry and regulations imposed, especially in the cannabis industry, could use with a little shift in thought process. Customers use test results to make decisions. Measurement uncertainty is associated with all of those decisions, not just cannabis. It's really not trivial either. So we really do need to treat measurement uncertainty more than just words on a paper of the standard and learn how to apply it. I know it scares many people because you think I can just bury my head in the sand, but it really is your friend, and it's there to help the defensibility of the laboratory. I remember assessing one laboratory, and they had developed all of their own methods, and I asked to see measurement uncertainty calculations, and they said, almost a direct quote, "We hired a consultant, and the consultant said it doesn't really matter, so we didn't bother doing it." I looked for a bottle of Maalox, and my eyes got really big and said, "Well, I suggest you spend some time thinking about that." So measurement uncertainty really is your friend. It helps share the risk with customers so that they're making decisions on all the most appropriate data possible. And also, it will help with putting regulatory statements of conformity into perspective. I may have failed, but how close was I to failure? Or it looks like I passed, but if another laboratory were to test this, would I pass it again? If I give, you know, 5 samples, how many of them are going to pass? How many are going to be on that borderline? So measurement uncertainty is your friend. Don't be scared about it. There are easy ways to do it, but you have to do it. And we have to impose measurement uncertainty as part of the decision rules whenever we're looking at statements of conformity. So here are some references, because this about wraps it up for me today. Here are some references that I think are pretty good and would suggest everybody review or at least check out online. I have printed copies of most of these and refer to them very frequently. And other than that, I want to say thank you for the opportunity to be here. Thank you for the opportunity to share some of my opinions and some of my thought processes in an area that I think is important for laboratory science. And I am happy to take questions. And as has been the case for a while, PJLA continues to offer free webinars. I think the next one's coming up tomorrow, or next week, next month, Matt Sicca. So stay tuned for that. But for now, let's come back and answer some questions. We have a few minutes.
Great. Thank you, Susan. Yeah, if you have any questions, again, please use the questions toolbar there on your right. Like Susan is saying, we do have a free, we've been doing this starting in 2024, some live workshops with our program manager, Matthew Sika. We'll be doing one March 19th on risk-based thinking. And then we have another free webinar with Michael Kramer, March 25th on doc and data control. So please, it should be on our website at this point. Go ahead and register for that at your convenience. Susan, I do have a question for you. When sure. people do the calculation for measurement uncertainty, was thinking about cannabis for a second, and they have determined their uncertainty for, there's so many different matrices. So they have to do measurement uncertainty for all different matrices for cannabis?
It's not a simple answer, right? If you're talking about a beverage, for example, that beverage uncertainty, the sample prep and determination of cannabinoids in a beverage is very different from a flower or a concentrate. So you're going to be validating those methods, those different matrices, commodity types. And so, yeah, uncertainty becomes an important part of the validation for each of those matrices. If you're looking at, you know, two carbonated beverages and you want to validate your method or verify a method, let's say beer and then a Coca-Cola, probably not. But if you're looking at, a flower versus a tincture, then yes, you do, because you're going to have the same, pretty much the same sources of uncertainty, but not all of them are going to have the, carry the same weight. They're not all going to have as a significant contribution in one matrix as it might in another. But that's up for the laboratory to determine, right? That's part of method validation or partial method validation. Remember that the Section 7.2 of the standard says that we have to validate methods to the extent necessary.
Okay. All right. I got a few questions that came in. All right. So thank you, Susan. So if your spec is equal to or greater than 4.5, hold on 1 second, my question bar just moved, be patient, because more came in, sorry. Okay.
I will write down the question, might take some notes.
Okay, hang on a second, sorry, I'm just trying to. All right, let me start over. So if your spec is equal to or greater than 4.5 units and your six replicates center around 4.5, can you ever confidently submit a pass-fail result other than being uncertain?
I personally probably would not feel comfortable doing that. Again, I'm always leery about spikes because not all of the material, not all of the samples are 100% binding to the spike. So I know that I'm going to have error coming off of that spike anyway in my recovery. And also, I have to tell you that when I hear spike recoveries, I'm hearing that an acceptable spike recovery is plus or minus 30%. Which is a huge space, right? Huge, huge margin. And so spike recoveries, I would still feel actually probably more uncertain in reporting out that single value without knowing the error bands of my value.
Okay, thank you. Someone had asked, can you give us some information about the calculations of W guard limit add risk associated? I don't know if that was something that was on one of your slides.
Say that again. I'm not sure I understood that.
Can you give us some information about the calculations of W in quotes guard limit?
Oh, guard limit?
And risk associated.
Yeah, I mentioned that on my slides, right? I gave you some, come back here. I looked at this, I use this particular equation. It's not necessarily the best equation, but it is one equation that I used that can be used for uncertainty, and it has assumptions based in there. And like I said at the start of this, we don't have enough time to go into all of the calculations and formulas that go into measurement uncertainty. This is just the one that I use to make a simple illustration for a very simple set of hypothetical data. If you come down here and look at, sorry, I don't know how to scroll through the slides without going through one at a time. If you look through the references, there are a lot of opportunities. Now, keep in mind, and almost 100% of labs fail to consider the contributions of measurement uncertainty that you're actually getting from sampling. When you go out into the field and you're doing a sampling of material, let's say cannabis, there is uncertainty that can be quantitated from that practice. And I have yet to assess a laboratory where I've actually seen contributions to uncertainty as part of the sampling exercise. But EuroChem has a pretty good guide on that, and I think it's really good. So I would encourage people to look at that. As far as actual measuring uncertainty or measurements of uncertainty, the GUM is pretty good. It's also very long and it could be dry. So again, I think EuroChem and several accreditation bodies have put out guidebooks to help laboratories make some of these determinations that I would encourage you to look at.
Okay. Someone also asked if we have a references of sites. So I think that's of right here actually pulled up, so that should answer that question. There is another question that came in about B89731. I'm going to hold off on that question and relate that to one of our other program managers. I will email you after this to get your question answered for that. Okay. Someone also asked about measurement uncertainty for microanalysis. What is the most probable number calculated?
Yeah, you know, there is MU that is required for micro. I am not a microbiologist, and I freely admit that, and my hat goes off to my colleagues who are microbiologists. I know what to look for as an assessor, how to refer you to review, how to determine measurement uncertainty in micro. Again, I would refer you to a EuroChem guide. That's what I go to. My go-to when I audit micro labs is my go-to guide is always a refresher using EuroChem. They do have a particular guide for measurement uncertainty of micro for micro.
Okay. I do and have
MPN is part of that. Yeah, sorry. MPN is definitely part of that.
Yes. What are the exact sites you use for your references page?
I have access to all of these. I use them all the time, so I put them up here. Exactly which ones I pulled, I would have to go back and look at all of the individual references, but because I use these all the time, I honestly don't remember where the specific information came for each specific slide.
Yeah, if you type any of those in, you'd be able to. They would come up too on those sites.
Yeah, you'll find, except for the hypothetical data that's made up, right?
I do have a question related to calibration. I think I'm going to hold off on that one again, and send that over to Mike Kramer, our calibration manager, for answering those questions.
Okay.
Really. Okay. Let me see if there's anything else. You got to thank you for your presentation.
All right.
Okay, that looks like. Okay, someone had asked if we have an example of measurement uncertainty in any analysis. I think what Susan talked about in her presentation today, it's she had examples of things that should be considered, but it might be difficult to be able to put something out there like that because of the laboratory is different. But yeah. Susan might have something available through her own company as well.
Yeah, you know, there are some that are out there. Obviously, I don't want to talk about any particular laboratory's data. This session was really not on measurement uncertainty, so getting into the weeds, no pun intended, on measurement uncertainty was not a focus of this particular presentation of this particular webinar. This purpose of this webinar is to bring in measurement uncertainty and to discuss how it relates to decision rules when we are making statements of conformity. So they're decision rules, statement of conformity, and measurement uncertainty are all interrelated. And so the purpose of this webinar was to bring a little bit more clarity to that relationship and not to talk about specifically measurement uncertainty. When I teach measurement uncertainty, it's a 8 or 16 hour class. So clearly we can't cover all of that in 30 minutes. Sorry. I'm good, but I'm not that good.
We also have a workshop, two of them coming up, 2 hour workshops on MU for calibration and testing. Again, look at the website, that's completely free for everyone. Or again, reach out to Susan if there's something particular that maybe she can separately help you with. Okay, I think that concludes our questions for the day. We just double check one more time. So, okay, yep, I think we're okay. Okay, well, Susan, thank you so much. Great presentation.
All right, well, thank you.
Okay, well, everyone, please enjoy the rest of your day. Again, this webinar is being recorded and will be on the website shortly after we end the session today. So feel free to download and share. And everyone, enjoy the rest of your week. Thank you again, Susan.
Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.